Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Follow Your Map. I am Abdul Abid. I am a surgical pathology fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And today we are talking to Dr. Justin Bishop. He is a professor of pathology and the director of anatomic pathology at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. I'm also joined today by a future pathologist, Meredith Herman. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bishop.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Starting off, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to medical school, and did your residency?
Sure. So I'm a native Texan. So I was born in West Texas and then kind of grew up in the Dallas area. And then for college, I went to Texas Tech, which is in Lubbock, Texas, and stayed there for medical school. So I ended up being there for 8 years. During which time I met my wife, who was a surgical ICU nurse at the hospital at Texas Tech. And so then we got, married and moved out to Baltimore within 2 days and started my residency at Johns Hopkins. It's kind of my backstory.
That's awesome. It's nice to hear that you met your wife there too. It's like as if it was meant to be, at the right place and right time.
It was great.
So piggybacking off of your journey into medicine, can you talk about your path into pathology?
Absolutely. So like many of us, I wasn't really aware of pathology as a field of medicine starting medical school. So I didn't really know what I wanted to do in medicine, as many of us don't. So trying to learn as much as we could. And it's in retrospect, I had my pathology course in my second year. But even then, I guess it never really occurred to me that these people coming in to teach me were actual, working physicians. And that this wasn't like their main job to teach us. They were donating their time to do that. Kind of when it came down to deciding what to do in your third year or so, I was attracted to kind of more the least paying subspecialties. The ones that involved a lot of thinking and less procedural doing. So my first kind of, thought was actually really liked infectious disease. I had a mentor there who was just great. I can tell you, Bob Kimbrough was his name. He was an infectious disease pathologist. He's passed away since then, but he was just one of these old school classic, infectious disease guys, just so smart and just knew a little bit about everything and a lot about infectious disease. And I kind of wanted to emulate him and be like him. And then, kind of looking into the realities of what an infectious disease career would maybe look like, it began to get a little less appealing. Around that time, you start looking at other things that involve kind of solving puzzles and thinking about things and making diagnoses. So I looked at radiology. My sister is a radiologist here at UT Southwestern. So I did like a couple weeks, maybe a month there. It was fine. It was good. It just didn't, grab me. And then kind of started rethinking about pathology as an actual career option. So then I did that month-long rotation towards it would have been at the very beginning of my fourth year. Still not totally decided by then. And then, I just fell in love. I went through all of AP and CP there at Texas Tech. And believe it or not, I thought I was going to go into microbiology because that kind of tied into the infectious disease, which I was still really liking and into. And I thought, well, here's a way to still be involved with ID but not, you know, do infectious disease. So I went into pathology thinking that I would probably do microbiology.
Oh, nice. What about ENT pathology? Was there a particular mentor that sort of guided you towards ENT pathology?
Yeah, so there at Johns Hopkins, so I was APCP and didn't really know, again, what I was going to do. I thought maybe I'd go into private practice or something. I didn't really know, but I did start kind of in microbiology, kind of thinking that was going to be my path. No pun intended. And I had a really great mentor there, a mycologist, a PhD mycologist named Bill Mers, who has also now passed away, unfortunately, but he was just awesome. Kind of similar to Dr. Kimbrough in a way. I mean, I find myself very drawn to these attendings who are kind of perceived as being very tough, very difficult, you know, but if you can meet or even exceed their expectations, then they would really, you know, notice, right? Like we have, you know, certain attendings who are just sweethearts and, you know, everybody loves them and they love everybody. And obviously they're a joy to rotate with, but you never really know if you've kind of done a great job with them, you know, because they say everybody does a great job, you know, but these tough guys or gals, you know, it's like, it's almost like a challenge to really kind of, you know, make them say you did a good job. But anyway, Bill was great. And so I thought, okay, this is going to be me. It's going to be microbiology with the focus on mycology, which is also very kind of a lot of morphology involved, which I really liked. But then the more I kind of did micro, the less I liked every other aspect of microbiology, the virology, the bacteriology. Parasite was okay, but, and it was also machine-based. It wasn't really as old-school morphologic that I kind of was liking, you know. Not that it's bad, it's just... Yeah. Even fungal identification was even at that time going more molecular than old school morphology. So when I really thought about it, I was like, do I want to do a whole fellowship in all of these different areas? And so that started getting less appealing. And the other thing is that at Hopkins, search path was king. I mean, like everybody, I mean, that was like everybody wanted to do some sort of search path. And it was like, that was the cool thing to do. So, you know, so I started gravitating more towards the search path subspecialty. Still wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. You know, I liked everything, almost everything, you know, so you do GI and go, yeah, I want to do GI. You do heme. Oh no, it's definitely heme. And so, I had always liked ENT, but I didn't think that there would be a lot of career options there. So my mentor in ENT was Bill Westra, who is up at Mount Sinai in New York now. And he was kind of, he still is, he's great. And he was kind of like perceived by the residents as, oh, that guy's impossible to please. And his cases are so hard, you know, you can never get the right answer and stuff like that. So I was like, I really want to please this guy. And so I, you know, I did like a elective in head and neck and spent a lot of time with them and stuff. And so then it turns out just by accident, you know, they were looking for, he was the only head and neck pathologist they had at the time on staff. So they were looking for a person to be kind of his junior faculty. And so, yeah, it was just kind of right place, right time. You know, he said, you know, would you be interested in that? And at the time, I didn't think I was cut out for academics. I hadn't really had any research background before my residency. And I thought I was just going to go into community practice and sign out cases and stuff. And he said, you know, I get that. He's like, I was the same way. I thought that I would be doing that too, but an opportunity presented itself and, you know, I took advantage of that and I ended up liking it a lot. So he's like, you know, I'm very similar. So anyway, I thought, okay, I'll give this a try. And if I don't like it, you know, okay, no harm if I, you know, after 2-3 years end up leaving academics and going into private practice. So long answer, but that's how I ended up staying at Hopkins and doing head and neck pathology.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for sharing all that with us. So in your opinion, what makes ENT pathology unique as a specialty?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how ENT pathology is perceived by others. All I know is how it was perceived by us when we were training as a field that was, again, very difficult to master. Mm. And so, you know, like you look at Bill's consults and it'd be like, oh, there's no way you're getting these right, you know? And so that's always kind of looked at it as really tough, really hard. The salivary gland tumor is impossible. Mm. You know, thyroid at the time was very, you know, nuclear features, and it was impossible to master. So that's how I perceived it. And that's what was so attractive to me. It was like trying to crack that puzzle. But certainly it's unique in the sense that we have a lot of different areas to master in a very small amount of space. When you talk about sinonasal, you know, the traditional ENT, oropharynx, or oral cavity, larynx, trachea, but then thyroid, parathyroid. I mean, these are all very dissimilar mm-hmm. organs yeah. that we're expected to be very comfortable with and handle. And then you add salivary gland tumors onto that, which is like a whole, you know, other world that, you know, are rare. There's a ton of them, and you know, you're expected to be able to be very comfortable with every single one and all the examples of, you know, variants and stuff. So I don't know. The squamous stuff is like what pays the bills and keeps the lights mm-hmm. on. But I think it's all the other stuff that really makes the field interesting.
Yeah. So in that regard, would you, can you share a case with us? I know you have seen a lot of very wonderful, memorable cases, but one case that has stayed on with you throughout your career that you think has impacted you.
Wow. Well, in general, you remember your screw-ups more than you do your successes.
Yeah.
You nail some awesome diagnosis, and that's a thrill for sure, and you enjoy it, but your screw-ups you remember forever. You know, and that's good because you learn from them. So yeah, the cases that stick with me absolutely the most and the longest are cases that I mess something up. But in turn, I'd have to think about that one.
Okay, you can think about it. We can edit some.
Well, I mean, like, you were, before the cameras were rolling, you were asking about HPV related multiphenotypic sinonasal carcinoma, and I certainly remember how that came. We kind of discovered that by accident. Hmm. And so I was still, gosh, I was either a senior resident or maybe very junior faculty. I think I was like a fourth year resident. And one of the Surge Path fellows showed Bill a case that was very weird. And so it was I still have, you know, slides from it. It was looked like all the world like a adenoid cystic carcinoma. And yet it had unmistakable high grade squamous dysplasia on the surface epithelium. Now, traditionally, those things should not go together, right? In fact, that's one of the important ways to distinguish adenoid cystic, a true salivary type carcinoma, from a basaloid squamous or some other surface derived carcinoma. And so, you know, we thought, wow, it's like, what a weird coincidence to have these two things going on, unrelated, surely. And so she had done, for some reason, I don't know. She had done high-risk HPV testing on it, which is not something that we were doing. Why would we, right? On any sort of sinonasal cancer, or certainly a salivary type cancer. I still don't know why it was ordered, but it was beautifully positive in both components. And so, you know, it didn't happen immediately, right? That was just the first case. But it certainly, you know, put in our mind, something's going on here. Like, this is something odd. So our antenna, you know, our antenna was, were up, and then we got a few more cases down the road, and it all kind of developed from there. So I certainly will always remember that case. Yes.
That is so cool to be one of the first to discover that entity, and probably never expected it would happen, but it sure did. So that is super cool.
That's usually the case. You don't usually realize quite what you're onto until later, you know. You know, we described a new tumor called microsecretory adenocarcinoma salivary glands, and it was sort of similar, I guess, in a way, but I remember those very vividly. I had a case, very distinctive looking, but NOS, couldn't put it in any category. And then one of our oral pathologists brought us an identical looking case the following week. And it's like, this is something. This has to be something. So at that time, what do? There's nothing you can do. You can't describe a case or a tumor based only on a couple of cases. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you couldn't do fusion analysis off of paraffin. Mm-hmm. You had to have frozen tissue, so which you didn't have. So I had nothing. I just held it. Held on to it, you know. I got a third, you know, but again, what can you do with three? Held on to it, and it wasn't till 4 years later when we really made that into anything. So that's, you know, you can't see all my, I have all these similar things that are just the beginnings of something maybe, but haven't yet blossomed into what they will ultimately be. But yeah, it takes, you know, recognizing that something is off, something is unique, having a good memory, you know, to find those old cases and a little bit of storage room.
Yeah. So you mentioned two of the entities that you have described. Are there any other that you were like on the first team to describe?
Yeah, we've been lucky. So I guess the other main one would be SMARCB1 deficient, and then later SMARCA4 deficient sinonasal carcinoma. Mm. So SMARCB1 deficient sinonasal carcinoma was, I had built a sinonasal cancer tissue microarray at Hopkins. It was primarily to facilitate the HPV-related multiphenotypic project, so we could screen a lot of cases for high-risk HPV and stuff like that. But we still had it, and has, you know, over 100 sinonasal cancers on it. And so from time to time, you know, you make good use of that. So this was at the time where SMARCB1 was starting, so the renal cancer revolution was starting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it occurred to me that there were a couple of new stains that we had brought in. I was the IHC director there at the time, that were more or less tumor defining in renal cells. We had brought in SDH and fumarate hydratase, and, you know, also SMARCB1. And, you know, our renal cell experts seemed very smitten with these markers, and if it had this result, then it was this tumor. And I thought, let's just try these on the sinonasal cancers. You know, what does it hurt? We could use them as validation cohort or whatever. So fumarate hydratase, SDH, nothing, you know, nothing came with that. But, you know, there were like five tumors that were clearly deficient for SMARCB1. And so it's like, that's weird. So yeah, again, at the time I didn't really know what to do with it. So it took some months before I you know, pulled those cases, looked at the morphology, and then you start to realize, gosh, this is a thing. You know, you don't really notice sometimes the subtleties until a difference is kind of found later, you know, either by molecular or some IHC marker. And then it forces you to really pay attention. You're like, gosh, these actually do look different. And so, yeah, those are the ones that come to mind. We did a new one kind of related to microsecretory called microcribriform adenocarcinoma. And we're always on to something. So we got a new salivary one that should be coming soon. And so it's been fun. Yeah, we've been lucky.
So on this note of all the exciting discoveries you've made in ENT, what is one of the most gratifying aspects of your job?
Gratifying. Oh, there's nothing like cracking a tough case, right? There's no greater feeling than that. Something you've really been struggling with, you know, it's like, gosh, I'm going to have to give a wishy-washy diagnosis, which I hate. I hate that. And then having some sort of epiphany, either through your reading or just something you notice, or through a colleague who notices something, and you go, you know, and you get that one marker, and it puts everything into place. It's, oh, okay, this all makes sense now. That's an exhilarating feeling for me. And you know, when you're in an academic environment, you get a lot of tough cases that you are forced to confront. Now, there's still a lot of cases you never quite crack, which is also kind of defeating, but the ones that you saw, I mean, that's the things that really get me going are that and the kind of treading new ground in the research aspect, making some discovery that is, you're just out there where no one's really been before. And that's a pretty exciting feeling too. So I couldn't imagine really giving either of those up, at least not at this point in my career. It's too fun, both of those aspects.
Oh, wow. You do like a challenge, definitely. So what is training like in ENT pathology? Talk about fellowships and is there a board exam after that?
Yeah. So ENT pathology is, there's a few fellowships, but I should very clearly note that I am not fellowship trained. Neither was Bill, my mentor, Bill Westra. Neither are a lot of the classic head and neck pathologists out there. And so I don't know everybody's background, but I do know that I was not fellowship trained. So when I was sort of targeted to join the faculty there at Johns Hopkins, basically from that moment that I kind of said, yes, I will do this, my training began, you know, and so I was expected to sit with Bill and look at his consults with him, preview them, and then look at them at 12:30 every day. Every day where that was possible. So, you know, not a possible every single day, but most days, you know, you're in the hospital, you can, you know, pop over at 12:30 for, you know, 30 minutes or so, and then go back to blood bank or whatever else you were doing. I even remember taking the metro from the ME to get back at 12:30 and taking the metro back to get back to the medical examiner. So, you know, so that started in my late third year and then continued on through my fourth year and then my Search Path fellowship year. And so by the time I was a full faculty, you know, I'd actually had, you know, quite a bit of training. So that's what my training consisted of. You know, there are fellowships, there's probably about a dozen of them now. They're a year long. We have one here at UT Southwestern, which is, of course, the best one. You know, they're all very good. You know, they're all a bit different, but they're a year long. There is no board. And, you know, ours is ACGME accredited, but I don't think they all are or have to be. So yeah, but basically, yeah, when it comes to kind of subspecialty expertise, you know, it doesn't really require a fellowship for head and neck or really most of the search path non-boarded subspecialties. It just requires the training and then somebody to say, yes, I trained this person and they are proficient in this field. And so even though, you know, I am not fellowship trained, it's never come up or been an issue with, you know, anything.
So on that note, going, you know, into ENT pathology, what advice do you have for trainees or medical students who want to go into ENT? What can they do to position themselves for this job?
Well, I guess first off, I want to encourage you not to, if you're interested in a field like ENT pathology or something else that is considered a little bit niche-y, if you love it, you should do it. And so I very nearly didn't do ENT pathology because of the perception that it was not marketable, right? We were told to steer towards one of the marketable subspecialties. I forget all what they were at the time, but you know, we probably know what they are, but that even that it changes, you know, from time to time and based on various trends. And so that would have been a huge mistake. Don't do something you don't absolutely have passion for. And believe me, you'll find a job that you will really like if you're doing what you love. Yeah. So don't let anybody scare you off like I very nearly was from doing what you actually really love and are passionate about and to get excited about every morning to do something that you know, it's not like you hate it, but it's just not what you love. I mean, you're kind of locking yourself in, you know, so you meet people who do these fellowships that do not love that field. I don't want to name any subspecialties in particular. But they feel that it will make them a better candidate for jobs or whatever. But you can tell that that's not really what they love. So anyway, that's first off. So in terms of, I mean, just like any field, you know, just try to get exposed to it as much as you can. And, you know, try to get involved with some sort of research project if you can. You know, when I'm looking at fellowship applications, sure, you want to see that there's an interest there, an established interest. This is not some person that is applying to every single fellowship, you know, and just, you know, you want to see genuine interest. But, you know, sometimes people come to these things late, and that's okay. So it's not like it's an absolute requirement. But I think everybody knows that that's kind of a good idea. But even if it's not in ENT pathology, just doing some academic something is better than doing nothing. And that's the other kind of mistake that I kind of did micro, and then I didn't know what I was going to go into. So I kind of held off on doing any projects, but then it was explained to me that just showing some productivity is better than doing nothing, even if it ends up not being in the right field. Like you did some derm research. Well, that's okay. You know?
Yeah. Wonderful. So lastly, I just have a supplementary question. You are also a co-author of the book, Handbook for Surgical Pathologists.
Yeah.
How did that come through, and like, what was that project like?
So yeah, that is very much the baby of Natasha Reckman. And so when I was a resident, Natasha was the search path fellow. She signed out, so we called them SPAs. But it's kind of like a fellowship. So we just kind of interacted then. And so that year, so there were always already kind of copies of I don't think I have them anymore. They were just bound and printed by her and spiral bound, and she just printed them out and handed them out. So there were already copies of that floating around. And so you try to, they were second, third, fourth generation. They were kind of lousy copies and they were all marked up and stuff. So, she did like a second edition. This is not like a formal book. This is just at Hopkins. Like right before she left, she did like a second edition. She's kind of a perfectionist. So it probably took her all year. And plus you're busy, you know, as a Search Path fellow. And so that became like the new kind of go-to for everybody. But again, there was no talk of getting this published or anything. But then, you know, so she left, she went off to train further in Sloan Kettering and stuff. And so I was proceeding along with my residency. And then by the time, I guess I was a fourth year as chief resident at the time. And I forget how she reached out to me, basically, because she needed help. She had gotten in touch with Springer, I think because of Diana Malavi and her book and her success. Mm-hmm. And so it was the same publisher, the same editors and stuff. And so she was looking to, you know, kind of somebody to push this over the finish line. She was too busy. And plus she felt she was kind of too far away from some of these subspecialties, you know? So, you know, that was really her thing. And I just kind of, I don't know, maybe 25% of it, just to push it to the finish line. The second edition, again, the further you get out, the harder it becomes. Like, I don't know anything about GYN FIGO grading. Anyway, I don't know this stuff. So we had to bring in Marina, who was, you know, I guess she was a fellow at the time, but more recently out of training. And so, I don't know, I'm not speaking for Natasha, but, I'm retired from that book. There's just no way that I could possibly do a third edition. I don't know anything anymore about anything other than my own area. But certainly, yeah, that was a lot of work and a lot of fun. And yeah, I'm glad that people find it useful. I certainly did. I still do. I use it as a kind of a quick guide, and we really wanted it to be spiral bound. That was our only regret, because that was so handy to have it, you know, just flip to the page and it was right there. We really wanted it, and Springer just wouldn't go for it. But other than that, it turned out pretty good.
Oh well. Wow. Meredith, do you have any more questions?
No, I think we talked about a lot today, and it was really exciting to meet with you, Dr. Bishop, and meet someone who made a cool discovery in pathology that is a new entity now. So yeah, thank you for sharing your journey with us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yep. So that's our show for today, folks. You can find Dr. Bishop on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @ENTPathology. And thank you very much for listening to us. If you like the show, please like and subscribe to our channels on YouTube, Apple, and Podbean. And we'll be back with another episode soon.
Special thank you to our listeners. Until next time, enjoy an excerpt from an upcoming interview with Dr. Agnes Fogel.
I think it is one of the fields, and there are multiple in pathology, where we are so totally engaged in an integral part of the care team. We're not giving diagnosis in isolation. Maybe more so than in many areas of pathology, the clinical setting, the laboratory data, influence how we interpret a somewhat limited repertoire of histologic findings and come up not just with a description of lesions, but an integrated clinical pathological assessment of what the process is, the etiology, what is going on, what the underlying processes are that are governing that. And of course, we get to work with nephrologists who are super wonderful people, very engaged. I call back on every biopsy that we have. We have a large volume, about 80% are outside cases that come to us as wet tissue for primary diagnosis. And it's great to feel as an active appreciated, essential part of the team taking care of the patient. And we have that in some areas of pathology, but not in every single one, in my opinion. Yeah.